Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Stephen J. Campbell. He's the Henry and Elizabeth Weisenfeld Professor in the Department of History of Art at Johns Hopkins University. And we're talking about his new book, Leonardo da Vinci, An Untraceable Life. Stephen, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you.
I don't know what I expected when I started this book, but it wasn't this book, and I'm really thankful for that. I thought it was going to be another, I'm not going to say BS, but I'm thinking it, book about Leonardo da Vinci, and it's not. It's what you call an anti-biography. Tell me how this idea of writing this kind of a book came to you.
I think it was because I've been teaching Leonardo for, you know, in a university, here at my university, to undergraduates and more recently to graduate students. And it was quite striking to me the way that certainly when you get towards the more popularizing literature, which sometimes you want to put in the hands of undergraduates, you know, who are not very acquainted with the more scholarly or specialist literature on Leonardo, that it's how often Leonardo's studies is framed biographically. Like, we're dealing with a historical character, and we have to explain his motivations, you know. You know, who he was in love with, you know, his relationships with his parents and his family, who his friends were, what he ate when he got up in the morning, and what he was feeling, you know, when things didn't go well. And, you know, it's just, much of that is complete invention, because Leonardo just didn't write that stuff about himself, and there just aren't those kinds of records for Leonardo da Vinci, you know. He didn't care about posterity caring what he felt. He was interested in getting his thinking down on paper, and, you know, which is a different thing altogether.
It's amazing when I started getting into the book in that manner. Because I realized all I know about Leonardo is this sort of weird manufactured image of this brilliant Renaissance artist, you know, person who invented flying and all this other stuff. And I realized how much of that, you're absolutely right. I just took it for granted that somebody knew something somewhere. But it really is like everything you know. Well, it's not wrong, but it's been exaggerated to create a public image that sells museum tickets.
Yep, absolutely.
So people, when they take their classes, I have to imagine it's like, oh no, it's a big bummer.
Yeah, I mean, even the inventions, you know, they're brilliant. His ability to visualize those machines, you know, they're dazzling. But there's, I often get pushback from the fact that those machines are based on other people's machines. I mean, they're based on books of drawings that engineers produced throughout the 15th century. Now, certainly in the case of flying, he made major strides. You know, he observed the flight of birds, and he was able to, you know, sort of speculate on the basis of that. You know, could you get a machine, a human-powered machine, to do what a bird does, you know, when it's gliding and, you know, and soaring and trying to land, you know, the operation of the tail in particular. But you know, in general, you know, it's quite specific. I think flying is the thing I would single out about the Leonardo as, you know, the deviser of machines.
But most importantly, there's a quote in your book from page 253. Mm-hmm. Any claim to explain Leonardo that isolates him from his milieu will be misguided and anachronistic. And I that's really sums up what I got out of this book.
Yes, he was never operating alone. The most responsible biography of recent times by Leonardo, it stays with the, you know, essentially the paper sources, the documents. And it's striking that as this biographer, you know, who's an art historian, a first-class art historian at the Metropolitan Museum, Carmen Bambach, as she works her way through the material, just like dealing with the paper sources on Leonardo in order across four volumes of this massive biography, Leonardo constantly disappears behind piles of paper. Because and thus those, that paper is negotiation with a whole host of other characters.
There's also weird lists.
Yeah, lists.
There's a lot of lists of just like everyday stuff that he need. Like it's almost like what he needed for art supplies or stuff like that, or things he had to do. I mean, people don't realize that there's a lot of stuff that Leonardo wrote that's not that important, or maybe adds to a little bit. How do we understand that time period?
Yeah. It's detail, and I think we have to consider all this detail. We have to. Yeah, maybe it's not important. You know, it's just not clear what we're supposed to do with it. If Leonardo says, you know, puts the word nutmeg in a list, you know, I think it has to do with toothache. You know, that people use nutmeg to treat toothache.
Yep.
Yeah. But strange details.
What it reminded me of, you have a wonderful series of reproductions in the book, and the very last one is something that I'd never seen before. Mm-hmm. It was a drawing of Leonardo, and there was just a rain of everyday objects you'd find in the studio.
Yeah, isn't it fabulous?
That's an amazing drawing.
Yeah. It's written on the back of it. There's, you know, with the paper, you have to reorient the paper. There are household expenses. And I think he was found himself just like bogged down by inventories, by needing to list everything, you know, for accounting, because he had to move house yet again. So there were lists and lists and lists. And I think it's just a point where there's just an accumulation of stuff. And
so that's a really brilliant drawing. So, that's really his expression of like, I'm through with this.
And then in the sky, you know, with all these like, you know, hammers and tongs and other tools are raining down from heaven. And you just get the sense of a cluttered workshop world.
Yeah.
And then we have Leo the lion in heaven, like on a cloud, going up in flames. and that's the pun on the Italian words, Leone arde, the lion burns, which, of course, is also Leonardo. So Leonardo is the burning lion.
Wow.
I read that as a metaphor for a selfhood dissipated into consumption.
Ooh, yeah. Now, in the first part of this book, it's a critique of how art museums, TV shows, writers construct a life, not just in Leonardo's case, but in general, the better to sell it. I mean, everybody's interested in selling, especially art museums, in getting people through the door. And so what they've done with Leonardo is really construct a life that will appeal to the general public. And it's amazing how much of that you've documented.
Yes, it goes back a long way. the Leonardo show seems to begin in the late 20th century. There's not so many, you know, throughout the previous decades, right? It's a Leonardo as spectacle, you know, that really begins, which actually a show in Boston at the Boston Museum
of Science.
Which they, I think they did another version of a couple of years ago. And that show, I don't know if you remember reading the papers at the time, was intensely criticized by art historians at Harvard.
Right.
Yeah. Because the way art was just, you know, thrown in as sort of like the icing on the cake, and the art had nothing, had very little to do with Leonardo, as it turned out. It was sort of like second or third rate, like imitations of Leonardo, copies, that kind of thing. Despite the attestations of so-called art experts who had an interest or two, you know, in keeping these things on the market and hyping them in an exhibition. That kind of spectacle. I mean, I don't want to totally put that down. I know when there are so-called Leonardo da Vinci museums, which consist of reconstructions of his machines. And it's, you know, it is fun and educational for people to go and see how these things worked and maybe to interact with these things themselves, you know. But there's a particular side of Leonardo's production that lends itself to that. But often the way art, drawing, thinking, you know, all these other vital parts of his life, of his production, are addressed in these exhibitions, it's just very questionable. It's much harder to get across, of course.
But it's also a trend that's going on in museums and actually traveling exhibitions. And I know I've seen a couple where it's really the spectacle of the artist that's being promoted, not necessarily what the artist was or who the artist was or how they painted. It's creating a spectacle out of that artist and their work.
Yeah. Yeah, the big Michelangelo Sistine Chapel exhibitions where you can sort of be inside the painting and, you know, just get all blissed out under Van Gogh's Starry Night. You know,
so that's the Van Gogh one just was here.
Yeah, and it looks really good in Emily in Paris, you know. it's a good scene there, you know.
But I think it's
incredibly expensive to get to see these shows, you know. It's almost like trying to go to see a show on Broadway or something.
It really is. Mm. But it gets to a really interesting point, and that's covered in your book. It's got to do with our relationship to the past, and the art of the past, and how we want to view that past as opposed to the way that it was. Mm-hmm. And that's a complex issue.
Yeah. I mean, I think we need to treat the past with respect. And not make sweeping claims to know it or to know everything or to make it fit a model that we have conceived in advance about the West technological progress of the West from, say, Leonardo to Isaac Newton, etc., to Einstein. And unfortunately, too many of the Leonardo biographies, you know, that like, you know, write about the, you know, great mind out of his time, they make him into a Newton or an Einstein before his time.
Right.
And I think it'd be an ethical obligation to the past to, you know, to be humble about what we don't know and to respect the differences between where we are now, wherever that is, and then 500
don't
years
go there
ago.
Don't go there.
Well, you know, 500 years ago, people thought the world was falling apart. I mean, Leonardo is... One of the reasons Leonardo fails to cohere as an individual is the kind of like constant disruptions he lives through.
Mm, absolutely.
He's a state collapse in several different places where he is working, notably the Dukedom of Milan, you know, where he spends 20 years. And that is, it's not exactly erased from the map, but the whole apparatus of state, you know, is destroyed by the invading French. The networks of bureaucracy and patronage that sustain the production of art, they're gone. And Leonardo is, you know, out vagabonding on the road again in 1499 when that happens. So there's that. So there's that kind of past difference, which, you know, maybe it's a weird distant mirror of the future, of our present. But we can't misrecognize, we can't over-analogize, you know, an artist inventor back then by thinking about him as sort of like a tech bro or, you know, an innovator or whatever, celebrity, you know, artist, influencer. That just doesn't make sense. You know?
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Stephen J. Campbell. He is the Henry and Elizabeth Wiesenfeld Professor in the Department of the History of Art at Johns Hopkins University. And we're talking about his new book. It's a book that surprised me in a good way. Leonardo da Vinci, An Untraceable Life. Stephen, I got to talk to you about Salvatore Mundi.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching, I think, HBO or something, and all of a sudden this whole documentary came up, and I didn't know what the hell was going on. And you have this in your book.
Yeah.
What was the story? Can you go over the story for the listening audience?
Oh my gosh! There's so many stages. The painting turns up in New Orleans, in this auction gallery right off Bourbon Street, there's two art historians, good art historians. They say, something interesting about this. So they have it cleaned. They were reconstructed, and they basically realize they have a 16th century painting on their hands. Mm. That's not too different, you know, not too far away from Leonardo. And with closer and closer examination, they make a case which, to my mind, holds that this is a damaged painting from the workshop, from the circle of Leonardo, and parts of it are good enough to be by Leonardo himself. All of this is disputed. I think it was restored responsibly by the chief conservator for the Kress Foundation, Diane Dwyer Modestini. She herself came to see me and showed me her high-resolution images, you know, of the various layers of the painting.
Mm-hmm.
sort of the damaged overpainting, but a lot of the underpainting was stable, various ways of treating facial features, eyes, lips, etc., that are characteristic of Leonardo. Anyway, at the end of the day, I'm agnostic. I think the painting is important regardless of its autograph status and regardless of its value. You know, that these are things not of interest to me. I think it's a historically important object. It seems to have generated a whole line of imitations. In other words, it was a characteristic prototype image from Leonardo's workshop, of which we have several. And the workshop or other workshops, you know, went on to produce, at least a dozen other Salvatore Mundis, taking their point of departure from this original. Now, of course, the subterfuge just gets really confusing, and you have to watch the Netflix documentary. and I have to say, there's two Netflix documentaries. One of them about the kind of the intrigue and the subterfuge about bringing the Salvatore Mundi to the Louvre for the great exhibition of 2019, and then the owner of the Salvatore Mundi said he wanted it to be displayed alongside the Mona Lisa, allegedly. This is what's alleged from the documentaries.
This is already
incredible. It was never supposed to be in the show, but the Louvre had printed up a catalog entry for inclusion in the catalog. They printed a few on the side as well, as a separate kind of publication. You know, this sort of 10-page, 20-page catalog entry, which included a technical examination of the painting, attesting to its autograph status. When the loan was pulled, the catalog, which had that entry, had to be pulled.
This is the weird part when it came to this in the book, because you went to look for a copy of this book, right?
I went to buy the catalog, and then I saw in the bookstore on the morning of December 10th, 2019. In the closing days of the show, and there was a little book about the Salvatore Mundi, and I just said, "Oh, that would be useful for the book that I'm writing."
Yeah.
And I bought it, and not thinking anything about it. And then a few weeks later, Deanne Modestini, was in my house and said, "What's that?" And she picks it up and looks at it and goes, "I wonder why they didn't tell me, the colleagues at the Louvre, that they were doing this." Yeah, this seems right, etc. And so she got in touch with the curator, and the curator immediately got on to me and said, "Where did you get this book?"
God!
And please don't mention it or refer to it. You know, this book does not exist. So I had this hot property on my hands, and I was worried, oh my God, are certain people going to be breaking into my house?
That's what it sounded like to me. But this is emblematic of what's happened with Leonardo.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This kind of crazy stuff, yeah.
I mean, it's absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. When you go through certain of his works, too, it's sobering to read, the Last Supper. Mm-hmm. And I love the title of your chapters, by the way. It's The Last Supper and Its Leftovers.
Yeah. Some people might, wince, but there you go. I'm glad you like them.
I loved it. It was interesting that the painting started to really deteriorate very shortly after he painted it.
Yeah.
Why was True. That?
I think, within a few years, the fact that it was undergoing distress and coming off the wall was quite visible. I think it's Vasari certainly notes it by 1550, but I think well before then there are records. I think the 1520s might be the first reference to that. Paolo Giovio. In any case, we do get very quickly a production of replicas,
and that's what people I think visually remember when they think of the Last Supper. They're remembering the replicas because the painting itself. Really faded poorly. It was just a shadow of its former self.
Yeah. And had been constantly repainted, restored, overpainted. In the late 20th century, there was going to be a great campaign that was going to take off everything that was not Leonardo, and then was like, uh-oh, we take off everything that's not Leonardo, do we have any painting at all?
Yeah.
So then it became a salvage operation to kind of recreate the painting. And I think it was done with remarkable skill. It's done with a kind of conviction. There is something there to see. that gives you the impression of Leonardo. And it's done with a certain amount of restraint, but you get the sense of impact from this painting. But it is a kind of watercolor reconstruction, with flecks of original paint, you know, embedded in this sort of watercolor matrix. But it makes more of an impression on the visitor than what I saw when I first went there as a college student in the 80s. You know,
You said you went there and there was no lines.
Yeah, there was certainly no lines. Yeah, you could just show up and buy a ticket. You know?
And now you have to wait in a long line or buy your ticket in advance to see this.
In advance and then still wait in a long line.
So we're almost out of time. And you mentioned at the very end of your book that two of the most powerful contemporary responses to Leonardo have been stage performances.
Yes.
Can you talk about that? Because I found that fascinating.
Yes. Mary Zimmerman's, I think it may have premiered, was it Boston or Chicago? The Notebooks of Leonardo da Vinci is terrific.
It's a theater work. Could you talk about what that was like? Because I didn't see it.
Yeah, it was basically, I think, 8 actors, and they basically just read, they perform Leonardo's lines from random parts of the notebook, including the kind of useless inventories, to some of the most technical discussions about weight and about fluid motion and about perspective. And these bodies are constantly moving on stage and interacting with each other, so when there's a discussion of perspective, you get they construct a perspective cage where rays proceed from the eyes of the actors, which they do with a kind of tape. So it's a lot of motion. They actually construct some of the Leonardo's bridges and other machines on stage.
Wow.
So it's plotless, but it never pretends to give you the person.
The
personality of Leonardo, because you have actors, who are people of color, mixed gender, whatever, and they're all impersonating Leonardo in different voices and different bodies. And the other one was Jeroen Herman.
Which was a dance performance.
A dance performance, which is electrifying. And he performs out of Brooklyn, and he is a disabled dancer, and he does these incredibly high energy, very intense, very expressive dance performances, in one of which he is basically in a sort of like antagonistic but also aspirational relationship with this perfectly symmetric body of Leonardo,
right,
the Peruvian man. Yeah. This is very moving. It's a mystical experience because it sort of escalates from these sort of depths of struggle and angst to something that's really uplifting about the second half.
I just found it fascinating that these two performances, mm-hmm, is that what you felt was the best contemporary responses, and not all the the other hoopla that, mm-hmm, that goes on. And by the way, for the benefit of the audience, I want to mention the fact that you do talk about Dan, what's his name's, books and movie about the secret of
Dan, what's his name? Let's call him that.
I would love that. Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code. Oh, my God. Do you know when that book came out? I think people, at least the people around me, thought it actually was real.
Oh, yeah. People around me told me to read it because it was real. And I was constantly asked what I thought about it. And I held out a long time before I read it. But I was teaching students, who thought that Mary Magdalene was at the Last Supper,
This is what you're contending with as a professor of art history.
Yeah, but it's fine. I mean, if it gets people into my classroom and gets them asking questions, I think it's fine. I mean, I think there's always some kind of return.
I love that.
On this kind of spectacle, I don't mind at a certain point. That was the thing, and I think that is the beginning of the kind of like Leonardo phenomenon. This is the beginning of the 21st century. We have the publication of the Da Vinci Code. We have the internet, the colon of that.
Right.
And then we have this sort of like, vastly overvalued art market at the same time, which is, pumping out like yet another Mona Lisa and yet another probably Leonardo, and sometimes a real Leonardo drawing, at you know, with the promise of vast wealth to be raised, you know, at auction.
Oh yeah.
And in the midst of that, the Salvatore Mundi arrived.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I can't believe what you went through with that book, essentially. I hope you have it in a safe or something.
I sold it to a collector.
Oh my God!
I no longer have it. To a collector of Leonardo memorabilia and rarities. Yeah.
You had to get rid of it because it was cursed.
I didn't want it in my house.
Finally, we're almost out of time, but this book contests the assumption that meaning in a work of art is to be accounted for only in terms of the will or intention of its maker. And the point is, we can't know a lot of times.
We can't.
We just can't. And you just have to accept that. You just have to deal with that as it may.
It's always about the encounter with other minds. When Leonardo is painting the Virgin and Child with St. Anne, he's putting himself in the mindset of a devout Christian, you know, which may or may not have been his own mindset,
yep.
You know, but he's, and then you have to enter into some kind of empathetic relationship with that image. And the images have a sort of empathy structure built into them, because the way his figures interact with each other, with their soft smiles, their embraces, their engagement of each other, almost the sense that they're physically kind of flowing together into a state of one being. The painting seems to want to do that to you as well. The forms seem to flow towards you.
Yeah.
There's even water in the foreground of the painting, sort of inviting you in a certain way to be caught up in it. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to leave you that the last word. My guest tonight has been Stephen J. Campbell. He is the Henry and Elizabeth Weisenfeld Professor in the Department of History of Art in Johns Hopkins University. And we've been talking about his new book. I found it really fascinating and interesting and fun in parts, too. Leonardo da Vinci, An Untraceable Life. Stephen, it's been a real pleasure.
It was great fun, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.